Hello and welcome to Disney Magic Hour, episode number 141. On this week's show, we're going to be looking at Touchstone in the studios. Ryan is going to lead us through Hollywood Studios and show us what relics of Touchstone pictures still reside in there. Right now, it's only me recording this, so say hello, Pete. Hello, Pete. This episode of Disney Magic Hour is brought to you by MEI Travel for all your vacation planning needs. For visiting Walt Disney World, taking a cruise, and traveling anywhere around the globe, visit the experts over at MEI-travel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure. We are Last Gen Podcast. You can find us at lastgenpodcast.com on the interwebs. On Twitter, we are at Diz Magic Hour Pod for this show. That's D-I-S Magic Hour Pod. On Facebook, we are Disney Magic Hour. You can just search for Disney Magic Hour. You can find this show on iTunes, Google Play Music, and Stitcher, or however you found it today. On Instagram, we are at Disney Magic Hour Podcast. And of course, if you want to support the show to maintain that it will keep a going and join us for our weekly live threads, you can head over to patreon.com/Disney Magic Hour to join us for our weekly threads. You just have to join as a production assistant, and it'll give you all the access to that. And we're working on a second idea because it's tough for everyone to make the appointments, you know, over at the live stream. You know, people got jobs and whatnot. Evidently, I don't know. That's what I've been told. Ryan isn't a part of this introduction right now, as it was a pre-recorded thing. But you can find everything that he does at the Main Street Gazette over at mainstgazette.com. Same with all your social media on that one. So on this week's show, we actually had really sort of a two-part show set up where we were going to discuss our impressions of Toy Story Land with a guest. And then we were going to talk about how Touchstone Pictures is still visible in some ways in Hollywood Studios, or in some ways that they're now gone. So that was going to really be like part one and a part two. Issue was, our guest had a power outage on the night that we were supposed to record, which was unfortunate and just bad timing. And then we had the holiday with July 4th. So we're going to get to that soon. If the latest will just make it something that me and Melissa do this week coming up. So we're actually going to jump to a segment that we pre-recorded, me, Melissa, Ryan, and Courtney on our normal record days. And we're going to jump over into that conversation where we are discussing, not only the news, but we'll get into the Touchstone in the Studios portion of this week's show. So enjoy that, and off you go. And we are back. Hello, everyone. Welcome back from that brief episode, which is Dr. Dre lyrics. Just in case anyone was wondering what lyrics would be quoted today, it's Dr. Dre. So we're going to actually get into a brief news thing. We didn't get to talk about this last week because we had Mr. Don Hahn on the show. So we didn't get to talk about the big news, which happened with the chief creative officers at Pixar and Disney Animation. Is that Pete Docter and Jennifer Lee are going to be succeeding in the spots where John Lasseter once had the power. So basically it works up that Pete Docter is going to be leading the Pixar Animation Studios. And Jennifer Lee, I believe she is going to now be in part the lead on the Walt Disney Animation Studios. Am I missing anything there? Any kind of specific wordage that I should have, guys?
Nope.
That's pretty much how I understand it.
I think they're both going to oversee creative affairs, so they're definitely going to be working jointly together, but I'm sure that Docter will have more of a control over Pixar products.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. He's in charge of Pixar. She's in charge of Walt Disney Animation Studios. So, yeah. So that works. So this is good. I mean, they definitely have two people that are more than able to fill in the shoes, and one would say it's kind of about time that someone not named Man or something like that was given a role.
Named Man.
Man Room. But Jennifer Lee getting the up from starting her Disney career as a co-writer of Wreck-It Ralph, and then of course directing and co-writing Frozen. I heard that did pretty well.
A little bit.
pretty good.
Also Zootopia.
Yes. I forgot about that, actually. She was part of Zootopia?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. And Pete Docter's been in, like, he's done everything for Pixar that you could possibly ask. I guess I know Pete Docter better because he's been with Pixar so long that is a very exciting pick for me. Mm-hmm. And when you look at the caliber of film that he personally has done up Inside Out Monsters, Inc., that's pretty cool. So I'm excited. You know, it's a weird time to have Toy Story Land opening when news like this is happening for the specific reasons that it is happening when you look at the company as a whole. But given the task, you know, put forward, geez, you really couldn't ask for two better people, right? I mean, Ryan, you know, I don't usually when a company goes through a transition or something like that, especially under the circumstances that you found that happened with Lasseter, you have a very big fear of a misstep or a skip in just the smoothness. I don't know why. I mean, maybe I shouldn't feel this way, but I don't really see that as a concern here at all.
No, I think Pete Docter is a very logical choice. I think he will keep the wheels, you know, running at Pixar if he hadn't really truly already been doing that while Lasseter was on the sabbatical time. He's been there for so long. I feel like that's going to keep that quality. That's going to keep that storytelling level up. On the other side with Jennifer Lee, yeah, you know, well done. Finally, you know, starting to keep breaking that barrier. Now we have a woman who's in charge of a studio or a piece of a studio, which is great to see. She's done some really good pieces for Disney. You know, she's a little bit, you know, of a lesser known quality as a whole. You know, she doesn't have as much longevity as a Lasseter, but you know, she also turned a story that even Walt couldn't figure out a story for. And with that team was able to craft a story around Frozen that worked. So I'm very optimistic on both fronts.
Also, Sabbatical Time is a new rom-com musical written by Courtney Van Rens coming to Broadway next summer. Sabbatical Time. It's a lot of dancing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Lots of Charlestons.
Yeah. Lots of dancing around things.
The band that we're going to get to later that she actually has that's going to perform in it. But
absolutely. We'll have the band on stage, Chicago style.
Nice.
Like the pizza.
I saw that play alone. There's a lot of places to see Alone. Chicago, maybe not one of them, but that was Alone.
Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, it was good stuff, though. I don't know, ladies, reactions?
I'm excited. I'm hoping that she is entrusted with, you know, wonderful things and allowed to bring her creativity, like how she brought it to Wreck-It Ralph and Zootopia, you know, bring that unique style and kind of just help the studios flourish. Pete Docter, I trust. You know, he's going to be great. I don't know. That was a great pick.
My son, the doctor, Dre. Courtney?
Is there any
downside that you see to this?
I have a question. So John Lasseter was over both sides, Disney Animation and Pixar before.
Yes.
So they split it. Mm-hmm. They took his job and gave it to two people.
Yes.
Which seems to be a trend that's happening at my job as well.
It's a little interesting that they like split the job and gave one half of the job to a woman instead of giving like the one job to one other person. But I see the necessity of why they did, because Pixar is doing more. The studios are doing more. So I see why they would have split it. But it is kind of difficult to not maybe go, that's interesting that they split it and they gave one half of it to a woman instead of just giving her the job. You know what I'm saying?
I think Pixar and Walt Disney Animation Studios, they were kind of two different monsters.
Yeah.
And since Lasseter had the experience in both those fields and he literally, you know, grew the one brand, that maybe made it a little bit of an easier transitional. Ryan, yes?
He also had some Imagineering duties. He also had, you know, he had a lot of pieces that he kind of had his hands in. And I think maybe this is, you know, a lesson learned. Maybe they didn't need just one person over all those pieces, so that if somebody does leave, if somebody goes away, it's not such big shoes to fill.
Yeah, I totally see the necessity of it. And I, you know, both sides are doing more now too. And I know that he did a ton. So I see the necessity, but I think that, I don't know, for me mentally, there's a piece of me that goes, well, that's kind of frustrating a little bit.
No, I feel you. I also think though, like you can take it as like, you have this person who has like years and years of experience. He's probably doing the job like with his eyes closed because he knows it. Like, you know, he's probably also delegated a lot of responsibilities out. But now you have, if somebody was going to come in and take his job duties on, like, it might be a little overwhelming. So maybe instead of initially putting that much pressure on one person, they're like, okay, here, let's split it up. And then maybe in like 5-10 years, we can kind of, you know, see how things are working out, you know, see how the studios are, you know, going. Are they still doing 2 Pixar movies a year kind of thing? Or, and, you know, 2 animated things a year and all that crazy nonsense? Or, you know, can one person then, can we smush it together?
Sorry. I definitely think that they each need a position. I don't think that one person should try to do both.
No, I think it then becomes,
I also think it's a kind of a different artistic aim sometimes.
Yeah, I agree.
Where that Pixar is very famous for saying, we don't make kids films.
Oh, yes, yes.
You know, where I don't know if that's the mantra behind Walt Disney Animation so much.
Yeah, and I think
it's a little more in their ballpark than Pixar. But Pixar is like outwardly said on multiple occasions. And actually, I saw a tweet today with Brad Bird. Mm. Someone was like, I really enjoyed the movie, but I won't be able to buy it. Why did it have to have such language in it? And he was like, well, we don't make children movies, and it was rated PG-13. He said, with all due respect, you know, we don't make kiddie movies, and it was PG. So you should have known that going in. So
what language? What?
I don't know. I tried to remember. Someone maybe says heck or damn. I have no idea.
In Incredibles?
Incredibles 2, yeah.
That's what... Okay, my mind is blank. I don't know.
I'm sure someone said... The hell? I'm sure Mr. Incredible said the hell sometime. At one point, someone should have, you know, with the or things.
Frozone. Frozone's yeah, really I was gonna the, say the maybe. Culprit we're all yeah. thinking of.
Yeah. It's snow, mother. All
right. Right. He has a whole repertoire.
You know how Marvel has the Max series? I need a Max series of The Incredibles. That's what I want to hear. All right, so yeah, so that was the big news that came out over the last couple of weeks. We're a little bit behind on the news. Also, we're not going to get into it because it's legality things and none of us really have any noise on that, but just an update on a previous situation that we have obviously been keeping an eye on is the Disney-Fox merger, and the deal was approved by the Department of Justice with the agreement that Disney would not be taking on some regional sports. Basically, those would be sold otherwise. So everyone in ESPN was like, oh. But yeah, you know, but there we go. So moving on. Ryan, we have some stuff. You know, we talked about Hollywood Studios in the first half of the show. And it now has its first of what will be 2 very definitive IP-driven lands. But not all IPs are dipped in gold. What are some of, there's some other strangies though, but they all focus around one studio, correct?
They do. So we were talking about doing a thing about IPs in the studios and what's still there from opening, what's not. And the more I looked at this, the more I started digging into it, I realized, you know, we could talk about the Twilight Zone, we could talk about Indiana Jones and Star Wars and all the big things everyone knows. I think, but what if we go to the other side and we look at Touchstone Pictures and we look at films that a good majority of the people you're listening to right now haven't seen and talk about where their place is in park history.
Duh. Yes.
Yes.
Dirty, rotten, so, filthy, stinking rich. No, what was it? Dirty, rotten scoundrels? What was it?
Dirty, rotten scoundrels.
Nope, Down and Out in Beverly Hills. Was that it? With Bette Midler and Nick Nolte? Wasn't that Disney?
That would be Touchstone. Yep, I believe that was one of them.
Yeah. That's an R-rated film.
Yeah, there were a lot of films, and like, there's even some interesting box office on some of these, like where it was one of 2 decent movies that Disney did that year, but everything else was so bad that you group one of, you know, some of these movies into that category when it really shouldn't have been. Lots of weird stuff. So to make it interesting, we gave everyone 2 movies to kind of everyone else besides myself, because I don't want to talk the entire time. We gave them all 2 movies to talk about. To describe to you guys, so you guys understood kind of what the movie was before we went into its place in Disney history, and that includes movies that they've never seen before. So this, we thought this would be kind of fun to see what they get right, what they don't get right. But the 6 movies we wanted to focus on, and some of you who maybe know Disney park history will understand where some of this is going to go real fast. But it was Splash, Ernest Saves Christmas, The Rocketeer, Dick Tracy, Big Business, and Who Framed Roger Rabbit. That's what we're playing with today, folks.
All right. All
right. I have seen one of those movies for sure. Two of them, maybe. And the other one's nuh-um.
This Big Boy did it. Just know that. Big Boy did it.
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 That's part
of
the one.
Pete, how many have you seen out of this list? Have you seen all of them?
Wait, give me the list again.
So it's Splash, Ernest Saves Christmas, Big Business, Dick Tracy, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and The Rocketeer.
Four out of six. You know what? You want me to start with one that I haven't seen?
Let's start with one that you haven't seen.
All right, we'll start with one I haven't seen. 1988 is the year, and Ernest Saves Christmas is coming to theaters. So, yeah, James Varney, as you all may better know, as Slink, the voice of Slink for Toy Story 1 and 2, James Varney unfortunately passed away, before 3 was made. You also might know him as Cookie in Atlantis. But what really got him going was car commercials. So this character, Ernest P. Worrell, or Worrell, how is it? What was that pronounced? Worrell or Worrell?
Worrell,
right?
How I remember it.
So he became this very popular car commercial character for this old car company. If you ever go on YouTube, you can do a search for like Ernest commercials and you'll get them all. So how they were worked was they would be a first person POV. I don't know. That's like redundant to say it that way. A first person POV of on a handheld camera. And Ernest was a character, and basically you were seeing the world through Vern's eyes, okay? Who I'm pretty sure it's his brother, or something, but cousin?
Yeah, it's never
really said, right?
It's you get some ideas that it's maybe a neighbor or a childhood friend because of how things play out, but yeah, you're never really totally sure.
So yeah, basically, Ernest is always a pest, to this character Vern, and it got so popular that they wound up having a couple of TV specials, and then they wound up making movies. How many movies, you ask? 9. As many days as Ferris Bueller missed in school, 9 times they made Ernest films. And it all really started with the one that predated Ernest Saves Christmas, which I think was just Ernest Goes to Camp. Was that what it was? Mm-hmm. So yeah. Ernest Goes to Camp was the first one. And then they make Ernest Saves Christmas. I'm going to give you the short on what this movie is about, and you tell me if it sounds familiar at all.
No.
Okay. So Ernest meets a man who claims he's Santa Claus, and long story short, the mantle of Santa Claus is passed down from person to person as the magic within that one person kind of fades out. And Courtney, what does that remind you of a little bit?
The Santa Claus.
It really is, though. Ernest Saves Christmas, it really eats the lunch of the Santa Claus without noises, without our Buzz Lightyear. So it's actually kind of stupidly not really connected to Toy Story again. But yeah, that was the overall storyline of Ernest Saves Christmas. These movies were never good.
You didn't see it?
Because I haven't seen this
you
one.
You mean a sleigh flying into outer space is not intelligent filmmaking?
No, it's an attraction at Universal Studios with Jimmy Fallon.
Maybe that's where he got the idea from.
Yeah, well, God knows he didn't get any good ones. So yeah, that's a thing. But here was the thing about these movies. How'd they make 9 of them, you say, if like none of them were ever well received? They were cheap. They're crazy cheap to make. That movie cost $6 million to make. You want to know how much it made? $28 million. Keep that in mind when I talk about the other movie they're going to talk about later. But that's how these movies got by. They were small, very cheap comedies that they're just mindless and fun. I have watched a couple and they're kind of good. But I also know people who genuinely like have a soft spot in their heart for these movies. Disney master artist Kevin John is one of them. I cannot tell you how many times a Ernest movie has been referenced, and the following sentence by me is, huh? So that happens more than enough times. But here's the real kicker. Guess... guys, Melissa.
Wait, ladies? I know what you're about to ask.
You want me to hold?
What you're about to ask.
Do you want me to hold? I want to ask Melissa first.
Yeah, I want you to ask Courtney and Melissa what you're about to ask.
Okay. All right. I hope this is the same question. Make me a list of the top three places that you would film a Christmas movie. Melissa, you first.
Canada.
Sweet Jesus, fine. Yes, Canada's number one. Where's the other two? Wait a minute. All right, whatever. Yeah, keep going. It's called boxing.
Colorado.
Though, whatever. Colorado, yep. Okay, I like it. Third. My God, woman. You
Vermont.
Fine, Vermont. Give me three more. Courtney.
Alaska?
Yes.
Wisconsin?
No one should, but agreed.
Russia.
You're all wrong. It should have... someone should have said New York, because every Christmas movie takes place in New York. That or Nakatomi Plaza. No, this was shot in Orlando.
Cool. Oh, God.
Where in Orlando?
Not only was it shot in Orlando, they don't even try to fake it. Yeah. They set it in Orlando.
It takes place in Orlando.
Yes. There's literally, you can see the big OIA for Orlando International Airport in the background of several scenes.
Well, I mean, Orlando has Christmas. This is not that weird.
Maybe the reason was because where did they shoot it?
On the studios.
They shoot it at MGM Studios.
Oh, okay. That makes sense.
They did. So just when this was happening, just Mortal Kombat Annihilation or Conquest was just a twinkle in someone's eye. So Ernest Saves Christmas. That's the connection that I found. Is there a connection in the parks to this oddity of oddities, Ryan?
There is, actually. So a lot of the places they filmed that were real places in Orlando. Like we said, OIA, you have... some of the houses, some of the neighborhoods is where they filmed. But the aforementioned Vern, the guy who you never see but is continually being just, you know, run over by his friend Ernest, his house, it was actually on the backlot tour, depending on when you look at the timeline. But when you would go down on Residential Street, which we all know Residential Street for, the Golden Girls house, the house from Empty Nest, there was this brown house that actually served as Vern's house in the movie, or at least the exterior of Vern's house in the movie.
Huh.
That's interesting.
I don't remember them ever pointing that out.
No, I only remember the
Golden
Girls.
Why you don't remember it, in case you did it, if you remember Residential Street, because this is actually going to play into something else we're going to talk about in a little while, but this would be where Herbie would come racing down the driveway. He would pop a wheelie, honk his horn, and pop open his trunk. And like they were like, you know, and everyone's like, say hello to Herbie. And that would be why that house typically got overshadowed, is because everyone's like, oh, we love Herbie.
Okay. All right.
I think the last time I remember the backlot tour, Herbie didn't come out like that. He was just, it was just two halves of Herbie.
He was smacked up on heroin. He was on the side of the road.
No.
If it was after he hung out with Lindsay Lohan, we can all understand what happened there.
That's a good point. The last time I remember doing that tour, they had Bruce Willis's raincoat and Sam Jackson's purple jacket from Unbreakable
cool.
on display. And I got a photo of that. And I was like, well, this will never get better.
Do we still have those photos? I think we do. Maybe I'll put them up in the group of when you got picked to be part of that special effects submarine thing.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I am.
I'm going to find those and I'll put them up.
I got hair. Got hair in them, folks.
Just since we did the aside, you've seen the movie poster, yes?
I have seen the movie poster. I have.
So,
this is a
yeah.
Good,
so for everyone who doesn't know what we're talking about Glass, which is Unbreakable's sequel and Split.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
That.
I saw the poster for Glass and I immediately had to share it because I was. Guys, there's a lot of movies coming out next year, and number one for me is Glass. Number two is John Wick 3. And then there's Star
it's high
Wars
on my list. It's high, stuff. High on my list.
Yeah.
I literally went, the minute the poster came out, I went and pulled up the Unbreakable soundtrack again and started playing it because I just needed to hear it.
I will say, but it looks exhausting playing Ernest. Unbreakable,
another Touchstone picture. So we're coming full circle.
My goodness.
But let's stay in the comedy realm because why not? And let's go over to Courtney, who had... I believe you had big business, yes?
I do have big business.
I got to look this thing up because I did not look this up.
So this was my sister's favorite movie growing up. I can't tell you how many times I had to sit through it. So the fact that nobody else has ever seen it doesn't surprise me and makes me a little jealous.
Oh my God, I have.
So, but I just want to see what Courtney has to offer us about what this movie was.
Okay, so I did kind of, well, not kind of, very differently from Pete, and I just wrote a synopsis. So I read some stuff, which there aren't many synopses mm-hmm. of this movie. So I kind of just read some stuff and pieced it together, and this is going to sound like hot nonsense. So here we go. Okay, here's my synopsis. Two sets of identical twins are born in the same hospital on the same night in Jupiter Hollow, one to a rich family and one to a poor family. Both sets of twins are given the same names, and an elderly nurse switches one of each pair of twins for the other. Now we jump 40 years in the future.
But wait, wouldn't the twins know they didn't look alike?
Look, I don't know. I haven't seen it. Really, I can't explain any of that. We'll ask Brian to in a minute. So we've jumped 40 years, okay? So the pair that ended up with the wealthy family are heads of the company Moramax, like I assume like Miramax, in New York City. Sadie is one of the twins. She enjoys the big business, but the other sister, Rose, wants to have a country life. She doesn't want to be in the big city. So Rose, which is one half of the pair that ends up with the poorer family, is the head of Hollow Maid, which is a company in Jupiter Hollow, where both sets of twins were born. Okay. The other twin of the poorer family, Sadie, wants to move to the big city. All right. Now, okay. Moramax, the company owned by the richer sisters, owns Hollow Maid, which is the company owned by the poorer sister, or run by the poorer sister. This, guys, it's very confusing. Okay, so the sisters from Jupiter Hollow want to go to New York City to stop the sale of the company. Moramax is trying to sell Hollow Maid. So the... this is so confusing, you guys. Okay, so Sadie is one of the two sisters in New York City who is, like, into the big business. She wants to stop the poor twins from coming to stop the sale. So the poor twins go to New York City. Sadie tries to stop them. Somehow men end up involved, some sort of love interest.
Sure.
And then the sets of twins, like, they're narrowly missing each other because Lily Tomlin and Bette Midler, like, that would be cute for them to be constantly like, oh, I almost saw you. So I guess that happens a ton. And eventually they meet up in a hotel lobby bathroom where Sadie of the rich twins is locked in a broom closet by Rose of the poor twins. And then the remaining twins stop the sale of Hollow Maid. Everyone gets boyfriends, and the movie ends. I've done it.
Fabulous.
That's remarkably accurate.
Yes. Killed it.
So you have the two. You have Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin, which if you need anything more than that to watch a movie, I'm sorry for you. But
also from the director of Airplane.
Yes. And they have near misses. So what also ends up happening is the twins keep getting confused for each other. So, you know, like the rich Lily Tomlin character went into the poor Bette Midler character, and they get, you know, and they think that they're the other one, and because they've never seen their counterparts, they don't know that these twins exist. And so it's, yeah. And then the boyfriends get involved, and then they kind of start falling for the opposite twin, but that looks the same as the person they're currently in a relationship with. It's just a mess. And my 7-year-old little sister loved it. And
weird.
This goes to show you that not everything was gold, but that movie is, you know, it's Bette Midler and Lily Tomlin. You should watch it.
Bette Midler had she was in a lot of Touchstone films, huh?
She was, because I think was Ruthless People?
Is that the thing I'm thinking of, Ruthless People? That's the film I was thinking of before.
I think that's Touchstone. I can't remember.
No, that's the one with Danny DeVito. That's the one with Danny DeVito and Nick Nolte.
Yes.
Down in Beverly Hills is something else totally.
Yes.
Something else totally.
Yeah.
And then when you say that, I always think Troop Beverly Hills, which is entirely different.
Which is also different. All...
Did I say that tonight? Was that tonight that I brought up Down and Out in Beverly Hills?
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
About 10 minutes ago.
Were we recording?
Yes.
All right.
Yes. You're good. So I made Courtney go through all of that. I made Courtney go through all of that literally to tell you this detail of what was from that film in the studios. Early on in the cocaine, you're close. Early on in the studio's history, where Disney Junior Live on Stage, Bear in the Blue, whatever you want to call that kid show that's in the Animation Courtyard area, it was a restaurant called the Soundstage Restaurant. It was a buffet for most of its life, and it had movie props from actual movies and things. But when that restaurant first opened, the Plaza lobby set that they had used for this movie, they had shuttled in and set up in that restaurant. So it was like you were dining in the lobby of the Plaza. They also, on the Streets of America, there are kind of steps that look like the Plaza, which were put in after this movie. They weren't used for the film. They were just added to the backlot for effect later. But that was the entirety of Big Business. But it did have a foothold with that restaurant for the first couple of years.
Did that restaurant, I think I might have asked you this, but I don't remember. Did that restaurant ever have an Aladdin theme in there?
We're it not did. Accepting questions.
Okay. I was definitely in there, and I was definitely remember the Aladdin theme. Because yes, that's where the camels came from, right?
That's where all camels come from, Aladdin.
The camels, there were camels there. They weren't the same camels. The camels that are in front of Aladdin's flying carpets or whatever that it is, that attraction name is, came from the Aladdin parade that the studios had. Okay. They had, and they actually went down the street and they turned and they spit on people then too. So then it was a little bit more random. So
that was when Hollywood Studios had good parades. Somebody pulled a picture.
It has had some good parades over the years.
I think it was Hercules. They had the Muses. Like, that was so good.
For a while they did parades tied to almost every animated feature they were releasing. So you had a different parade every couple of years tied to something that was theoretically popular at the time.
And that was like the peak of when I was going there. And like, I know everyone like spent a lot of time in Magic Kingdom, but my family, I remember so much of Hollywood Studios and those parades. Particularly.
The early years of the studios had a lot of things going for it. Like, and it was a lot of hit or miss, but it was a lot, like there was a lot going on to take in, really.
Yeah.
When you look at it. But let's stay on this vein and let's go to Melissa, whom I gave the movie Splash to.
Mm. Which I think I definitely remember seeing at some point in my life, but I was definitely younger and I definitely don't remember the entire movie. But it's a pretty simple plot.
How dare you?
It's simple. But it was directed by Ron Howard, so that's always good.
Who?
She gave him a side eye. And then, of course, it stars Tom Hanks and Daryl Hannah, also John Candy and Eugene Levy for the laughter. Basically, young boy is saved.
Okay, I'm sorry. That's just like... Okay, I'm good. Young boy saved, yes. I'm sorry.
I'm going to put you in the corner and shut your mic off. You get a timeout.
Okay. I thought I was like, no, not big. My brain immediately said that because you said the word Tom Hanks, then young boy, and I'm like, no, not big.
I knew that's where your mind went. I was like, no, stop.
No, he was a young boy. He was saved from drowning. Of course, he was saved by a beautiful mermaid. Then, of course, we have another... time jump in our movies 20 years later. Now it's actually Tom Hanks. He is not doing so well in terms of life on dry land. He meets beautiful woman. He falls madly in love with her. Of course, then evil guys come in, find out she's a mermaid, want to use her for diabolical means or whatever, and they have to escape from some research facility somewhere random. Wikipedia wasn't great on details. But then they escape, and then Tom Hanks has to make a choice of either living forever with his love in the ocean and giving up his life on dry land or staying on dry land. Life on dry land stinks, so he goes into the ocean with her, and they live happily ever after under the sea.
Yeah.
So Tom Hanks drowns? Like, that's the end?
No, yeah. Tom Hanks goes full, like, water world and is able to, live underwater.
Yeah, he could survive underwater as long as he's with her.
In, like, shirts and pantsuit. Like, it's it looks uncomfortable. After a while, it'd be like, this is chafing.
Guys, it was nominated for Best Writing.
Ultimately, Tom Hanks is naked underneath the sea.
It was nominated for Best Original Screenplay.
It was nominated, but may I bring up something?
It didn't win.
No, it didn't win. It was co-written by a man named, and I'm not making this up, Babalu Mandel.
Makes sense.
Which is one of the greatest names I've ever heard in my life. And I want to just... This is the movies that he had fingerprints on. Night Shift, Splash, Spies Like Us, Doctor, Gung Ho, Parenthood, City Slickers, League of Their Own, Forget Paris, which is actually really good. Good little movie. Ed TV, not that good. But he also wrote the screenplay for The Flintstones, which earned him a Razzie in 1992.
I like that movie.
Well deserved.
I like that movie too.
Two out of the four people in this forum are correct on their opinion of The Flintstones. The other two.
The girls win. Oh, yeah.
It's so often how that's a dividing line for us. I'm not quite sure. The not the right versus wrong thing, the boys versus girls thing. So Daryl Hannah really, she had the mermaid effect that Ariel needed. Like, it was just when her scales dried out, they turned into legs. Like, that's really the mermaid effect. Like, that's really the ability you want if you're going to be a mermaid.
Yeah, like, I remember there was a scene with her in the bathtub, and she had fins in the bathtub in, like, his apartment or something.
Yeah. I would say that, like, if we were going to watch that... Well, I guess we are. Are we?
Okay, I put something in here so that we... Like, there's the option later of whether or not we do these again.
We're not watching 9 Ernest films. I'm telling you right now, that's not going to happen. But, like, if you had to pick an iconic scene, probably Splat. I'm sorry, Courtney. You are not okay with that? You want to watch?
I mean, if you get a great movie ride film series, then I want an Ernest film series. That's how we get exactly no one to listen.
Yeah, that's a zero.
I've done the science. Zero. This is what it adds up to.
So let's talk about the foothold this had on the series. And this one actually had some longevity to it. But rather overlooked, actually. There is a point there in the movie where Daryl Hannah's character, Madison, gives Alan, Tom Hanks' character, a fountain as a gift. It has mermaids and it has some other figures on it. And this lived for a very long time between over in the backlot area, right between the studio's catering company and the restrooms there. Like, there's that little fountain. Like, there's a lot of concrete in that area. And then there's this one little fountain, and it's actually the fountain from Splash.
I remember that.
So
I do remember that.
Didn't it also... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go. No, go ahead.
Wasn't this also... I mean, this is the Splash Mountain, right? This is ultimately where this came from. Or where Splash Mountain came from. This was the trick that Tony Baxter pulled.
This was the trick, because they thought this was going to be this huge movie. They were going to build this attraction to it. And then it didn't quite work the way they wanted it to. And they developed Donald Allen down the line to what it became in Frontierland, what we ended up with. Splash 2, which is a sequel that didn't feature any of didn't have Daryl Hannah or Tom Hanks. There's some of the houses actually on Residential Street there were used as facades as well. But tying it back to our Herbie theme,
watch
this. The actual molds for the mermaid and the dolphins on that fountain were originally used as mold, they're originally molds or ice molds for ice sculptures in Herbie Goes Bananas. There you go.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Proof the devil lives.
So, all right. So we've kind of gone through what I would call is, you know, you had some big names, but you didn't have, these aren't things that have longevity. These aren't films that I think have gone through everyone. What are we looking at?
I just want to show. So if you look at the poster for Splash.
Oh, the lettering.
If you look at the poster, if you look at the word Splash.
Oh, yeah.
That's the lettering from the attraction.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. It does look like that.
So, weird little thing.
Look it up, everyone.
Yeah. Also, I think it's kind of the same lettering as what you got for Spectrum Magic, if I'm looking at it right.
Sort of ish. A little bit.
Yeah. It's in the same family, if not
close enough. It's in that vein.
They're like, we like that S. Let's keep using it.
All right.
Babalu Mandel.
No. Let's see. Where do I want to go next? So we're going to go to movies that you probably have at least heard of if you haven't seen. Let's go with, you know, let's go with the one we watched just recently. Let's go with Who Framed Roger Rabbit, because this has a lot to talk about in terms of footprint in the studios.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm in charge of Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
You are. Were you able to cut that down from a 10-page thesis statement? Or
yeah, I was a little bit. However, I love this movie, and I forgot how long it was and how much crap happens in it.
There's a lot that happens in this movie.
It was like impossible. I cut out like probably 2/3 of this movie, and a lot of that stuff was important in my mind.
Yeah, the movie is not light on plot.
No, a ton of stuff happens. So this is what I came up with, and it's still very long. So bear with me, people. I'll try to be entertaining here. So here's your synopsis. A celebrity cartoon rabbit, Roger, has gone bananas for fear that his very curvy cartoon human wife, Jessica, is cheating on him, which is seemingly confirmed through photographs of a game of patty cake taken by hired detective Eddie Valiant. The man in the photos and owner of Toontown, Marvin Acme, is found dead the next day, and the main suspect is, you guessed it, Roger. Valiant is recruited by Roger to help prove his innocence. Valiant reveals that he believes Acme was murdered by Maroon, who is Roger's boss, in an attempt to gain control of Toontown, which Acme supposedly left to the Toons in his will, and his will is now missing. So it turns out that Maroon wasn't the mastermind after all. It was the evil Judge Doom. And we also find out that Jessica isn't bad. She's just drawn that way. There was no cheating involved.
Mm-hmm.
So Doom captures Valiant and Jessica and reveals his plan to wipe out Toontown with his dip concoction. Just before Doom dips Jessica, Roger appears and is also captured. But Valiant bursts into antics, causing Doom's evil weasel henchmen to laugh themselves to death. Doom ends up literally steamrolled, but reinflates, revealing that he isn't a human, but the Toon that murdered Valiant's brother years earlier.
He's a Toon.
Doom tries to murder Eddie with a buzzsaw, but Eddie is able to release the dip and kill Doom in the process. It turns out that they had the will all along, which had been written in disappearing and reappearing ink. Toontown is saved. Fiend.
Yay!
That was good.
And now I just want to go watch that movie. What?
I'm sorry. I just had a revelations.
I'm ready.
What?
I forgot. So we all know Charles Fleischer is the voice of Roger Rabbit, right?
Yeah, we do.
Darling Charles Fleischer.
Who?
He is the creepy man who collects the movie posters in Zodiac. The scene in the basement, that's Roger Rabbit. Now imagine that scene with Roger Rabbit's voice.
I don't want to imagine that scene with Roger Rabbit.
That's horrifying.
Poor Tobey Maguire.
That's Jake Gyllenhaal.
Whatever. Interchangeable guy.
Oh, yay.
We're on to the second generation of that now. It's kind of starting to feel like.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of Roger in the studios.
Yeah.
There's still a couple of pieces. This is what I want to think. Like, who remembers part of this, and who remembers like seeing parts of this? Yeah, I knew Melissa was my go-to for this.
Me, I can't tell you how many times I laid under that bulldozer with all the bricks around. I did that many a time because also it was that same, what was it, the Acme area. You can get your photos taken like with the green screen or whatever. So we did that a couple times. But yeah, I constantly laid under the bulldozer that had come through the wall to flatten you.
Unsafe.
Nope.
Yeah, this was so that they actually had, you know, where you kind of get onto the back lot tour where you did before they've started all the refurbishments. That was the loony bin. Like, that was Acme's building, and they had the boxes that had sound effects when you open them. Mm-hmm. It was really one of the first places Disney used the green screen to put you, like with Benny the Cab or Jessica Rabbit or any of those characters. You had the steamroller photos. You had a cutout of Jessica Rabbit you get your photo next to. I'm sure there were no creepy photos of that.
Don't Google that.
Yeah, don't. I wouldn't recommend it, but go ahead. They had the dip mobile, and it actually did move for a while with the backlot tour. Like, it would, as the tram would turn around, it would kind of roll out at it. And then when they realized they had so much space that they needed to open up some of New York Street, they kind of just put it behind a fence so that it was just sitting there, but you couldn't get to it. But there were a lot of props tied to this movie. They had Eddie's car. They mm-hmm. had some of the trolley cars. They had all this, and they weren't. It wasn't like they were behind ropes. It wasn't like they were behind anything. You could go physically touch them and take your picture with them.
Was the Weasel's car there too? I think I really was, remember that one.
And it's actually still there. It's moved over to Backlot Express. It's down in the outside kind of seating area. I can't remember if the Toon Patrol logo is still on it or not, but it's the same vehicle. And for a while, it did have the logo. I'm not sure if it's remained. But that vehicle is still there. Roger Rabbit was really kind of the icon for the park, for the studios when it first opened. I mean, to the point where he put his handprints and feet prints in cement the day the park opened. Still there if you're looking for like outlier pieces of Roger Rabbit, you can look at there's the maroon cartoon billboard by Echo Lake. Mm-hmm. And then if you look across over above Hollywood and Vine, it's Eddie Valiant's office where apparently
that's where it was.
Yep. And where and apparently they gave whiskey to Roger again because he's gone back through the blinds and it's a cutout, which these days is a little vague on what character it is because some of the blinds have fallen off and broken and they haven't been replaced over the years near the legs. But the head is still definitely Roger. but yeah, this had quite a presence for a long time in the studios.
Yeah, I definitely remember that whole Acme area. I would always go there. Like I said, we went to Hollywood Studios a lot when I was younger. So definitely remember the green screen, the pictures, the steamroller for sure, the bricks kind of littered about, the boxes that you could like, you know, either open or you could touch, right? And the sounds would come out.
Yeah.
Didn't they have like the big bomb like looking things?
Yes, I feel like there was always a box of swinging swords. That's the thing, like I remember.
Singing swords.
They had a stack of them. I don't ever remember them. I don't remember you could open them and they did anything.
No, I don't think they did anything. They were just there, yeah.
They had a bunch of props. They had, like, the giant anvil. Mm-hmm. The ton of bricks were sitting there, which some of that lived on until they just recently closed the area over there in that little gift shop. You could still go there. And even still, so the effect that made Benny work was literally like a little go-kart with one seat for Bob Hoskins to sit in is in the Backlot Express. If you go in, if you're looking at the counter, it's on the left in that back far left corner. There's okay. actually a little – you'll see it. It's a little like go-kart looking thing. And if you look at it, there's actually a series of drawings where they showed you that he would sit in this chair and then they would screen cap that. Then they would draw Benny. Then how they would put the stages of putting those two images together to create the effect. And so they have the car there that you can that's still sitting there. It looks really old and beat up because I think people have just, you know, not taken very good care of it over the years. But it's still sitting there. So a piece of Benny still lives in that corner if you go looking.
Man, Bob Hoskins is all in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's all in. And I remember like this was something I saw when I was very young. And I had no idea that Bob Hoskins didn't actually sound like that in real life. Mm-hmm. And then later it was like, the hell is wrong with this man's voice? You know, because I just assumed that was his real voice. You know, between that and Super Mario Brothers, that was pretty much cemented into my head. And then I was like, oh, wait, no, he does other films.
No. It bums me out that that stuff is gone. I didn't even know, and I didn't go enough when I was younger. I love this movie and I've collected Jessica Rabbit stuff for like 20 years now. I had no idea that any of that was there. That's very sad.
Judge Doom won.
Aw.
It will be called a freeway.
I mean, at least it's Christopher Lloyd.
Funny little stupid Christopher Lloyd thing that someone thought of a while ago. How did this work again? That was it. In Star Trek, all right, he was in Star Trek 3, The Search for Spock, and they stole his ship. And then they time traveled with that ship. So they time traveled with Christopher Lloyd's spaceship. So the man just got tools for time travel and left and right, leaving them all over the place. But yeah,
that's why he doesn't age.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you want something real fun, go on YouTube and try to find. Not that I recommend watching this show, but Whose Line Is It Anyway? Ryan Stiles. At one point, they asked him to like act out he had some character he had to act out. Back to the Future in 90 seconds. And just like we're doing here, he had never seen the movie. And so he's literally trying to act out Christopher Lloyd and Michael J. Fox with no idea what he's doing.
Oh, that's wow. Pretty good. Is that you, Melissa?
No, but It's so close. I found a Google image of like two girls laying under the bulldozer. And like,
oh, that's terrific.
That would totally be me and my sister.
That's awesome.
Yeah. I think I did that so much my parents stopped taking the photo. I'm like, just one more. And now I can't find any of them. Like, they don't exist anywhere so far as I know. But
we took so many photos at Hollywood Studios. We took like two rolls of film of the Beauty and the Beast show. Like when it was like in the theater where the seats were all level instead of like the amphitheater type.
Yeah.
I gotta go through my mom's pictures. So many photos.
Frank Welker voiced Dumbo in that movie?
Did he even talk?
Yeah, because they're the trumpet. They're like a kind of thing at one point.
Oh, wow. That's really cool. I didn't know that till just now. That is really, really cool. Nice.
But so you mentioned the original Beauty and the Beast stage show. So I'm gonna go ahead and go to Dick Tracy now.
I don't know how that transition that basically works.
That has nothing left in the studios, but was also really big in the early years, and is arguably up there with one of my like one of my guilty pleasure movies of all time. So let's go through Dick Tracy.
All right, Dick Tracy, 1990. Young Melissa had no idea what she was watching. It was directed by Warren Beatty, starring Warren Beatty as Dick Tracy. You had Al Pacino as Alphonse Big Boy Caprice. I like that.
In one of the most Al Pacino-ass Al Pacino performances of all time. The man could ask for a napkin. He's screaming it.
Also, Warren Beatty also produced the movie, too.
Oh, like, my goodness.
He just took every role. He just wanted all of it.
He wanted it to be made. We have, what is it, Glenn Headley? Glenn? As Tess.
That's Headley! Sorry, go ahead.
I knew you were going to do that. Madonna was in the movie as the most James Bond named Breathless Mahoney.
Oh, well, okay. You know what? Maybe it's really the most Dick Tracy thing because one of those outdated the other. I think Dick Tracy was older.
Yeah, the comics were in the 30s, yeah.
Yeah.
But I think James Bond had more terrible names. But
oh, yeah.
There was also, of course, Trench. Dustin Hoffman, Dick Van Dyke, Kathy Bates, Catherine O'Hara. I mean, there's a lot of stars in this one.
Yeah.
I guess quick synopsis. We have, of course.
Good luck.
I watched it today,
so yeah.
Good. I'm going to leave a lot of points out. Courtney did a really good job with her plot points. Me, not so much. So you have, of course, I found the summary, and I think when Ryan was telling us what to do, he said, you know, like the back of the VHS cover. So here you go. Hard-boiled detective Dick Tracy is searching for evidence that proves Alphonse Big Boy Caprice is the city's most dangerous crime boss. I mean, if that's not a back of a VHS, I don't know what it is. So we basically have Dick Tracy and his girlfriend Tess. They adopt this Kid. Is his nickname right? Kid?
That's his honest name.
Kid.
It's like a chap. It's a Chaplin-esque nod is really what it is.
A little kid who had been witness to a mob hit by some of Big Boy's goons. Tess and the kid leave town after thinking that Dick Tracy is two-timing her with Breathless Mahoney. But Breathless Mahoney's not really into Dick Tracy. She's just trying to use her feminine wiles to get one over on him. Because, mm-hmm. Of course, she is. She is a singer at one of the bar rooms that's kind of run by the gangs. There's a ton of terribly named gangsters in this that I'm not going to even name any of them. But basically, it's Dick Tracy's got to figure out a way to bring down Big Boy. But, of course, girlfriend Tess gets kidnapped by the blank. Who winds up being...
What? Don't ruin it. I'm just kidding.
Winds up being Breathless Mahoney. She dies. Spoiler. There you go. And my favorite part was reading the ending where good guy, of course, wins. Dick Tracy wins. He gets to propose to Tess, the love of his life. And as soon as he hands her the ring, him and the kid, also now known as Dick Tracy Jr., have to run off to stop a robbery. Because...
So he doesn't even really propose. He's stumbling through it. I'm just gonna, and
go, please.
He gets the call. He starts walking out. He literally throws her the ring box across the room.
Perfect.
But it's really something. Yeah. So the mobsters in this are ridiculous.
They're
flat top, prune face, mumbles. Like
can we run through this cast? Can we?
I mean, go.
Yeah. We have to. I'm just gonna say who's in it. All right, so whatever. You said a number of them, but if I repeat, I apologize. Dustin Hoffman, Dick Van Dyke, Mandy Patinkin, William Forsythe, James Caan, Paul Sorvino, Charles Durning, James Keane, Henry Silva, Catherine O'Hara, you said. Seymour Cassell is in this. Charles Fleischer is in this because evidently he's everywhere. Robert Costanzo, which if you look up that name, you will recognize him. This is just a ridiculous cast. It's a ridiculous cast. Either they all took especially the top players. Maybe they just took like a pay cut to keep that budget under control.
Because none of them have big parts either. I mean, there's really not a ton of.
Didn't Pacino get nominated for this?
Yes.
He did. He got nominated for Best Supporting Actor.
But it didn't win for that. It did win for Best Art Direction, Best Makeup, and Best Original Song.
The makeup is ridiculously good.
Yeah.
Awesome. It is. So if I were to tell you that this movie came out the same year as The Little Mermaid, and they both had, if I were to ask you which one did better at the Oscars, you're gonna say Little Mermaid, and it actually was Dick Tracy.
I tell you, man, Big Boy did it. The Big greatest it. Trick the devil ever pulled is convincing some people that Madonna can act.
So this movie had a lot of things that were, you know, they got away with some things in this movie. There are some jokes that Madonna makes, or some lines that Madonna says that is just like. The things they got away with on this are just great.
Don't worry about it. What's one of them? You got one?
She shows up at Dick Tracy's apartment. He thinks Tess is there. He asks what flavor ice cream she got. And she goes, fresh peach, but you better hurry and eat it. It's starting to run a little.
Okay. Like, all right.
Courtney was at one point, like you could see straight through her clothes. I mean, they were like, sure. And, you know. We're just going to go with it. No one's going to pay attention.
And so if that mom who complained about The Incredibles, guys, this was rated PG.
I was going to look up what it was rated.
Oh, it was. Also, oh, that's exactly right.
Also, Splash had nudity in it. PG. Your kids will be fine. Don't worry.
Wasn't it before the PG-13 rating?
I think PG-13 was first implemented with Temple of
Doom.
No,
it was after that.
No, it had a PG. Temple of Doom is a PG-13 movie.
Yes, because it was Raiders that he said he needed the boundary, and in Temple of Doom, I believe, is where it launched.
Oh, I thought I knew it was an Indiana Jones film. I thought it was after Temple that it got implemented, because it was some other movie that like actually forced it. I just looked it up recently. I don't remember.
Oh, you know what? No, they have it listed as PG in the IMDb. So it's what was the first PG-13 movie? Let's look it up.
I just looked this up not too long ago.
Do you remember what it was?
I don't remember what it was. It wasn't one that I had.
Does Courtney know what it is? Or is she
no,
just,
I don't. I was just saying, Melissa was right. Melissa was right.
Red Dawn.
Okay, yeah.
In the same year as Temple.
That was why, like, Temple.
Forced it?
Like, yeah, Temple was, like, the last, like, straw. It was like, no, if this is PG, like, we need something else.
That makes sense. Yeah. Man rips a man's heart out.
Spielberg went fighting for it because he was like, I really don't think this is this, but it's not this. And he was the one who was pushing. Yeah.
Yeah, because he's like, it can't be R, but it's definitely PG.
Yeah. So, and apparently it didn't matter even for this movie. We're like, no, we're fine. We're going to go ahead with what we're doing.
What year was that? What year was Temple?
Wait a minute. Oh, now I'm reading that Spielberg was the one who got it made.
Yeah.
Yes. Because he wanted it for Temple of Doom and they didn't get it in time. Like,
oh, okay. All right.
So what year?
It was all 80. Well, that Temple was 80, 83? No, 84. 84. I think so. I keep going. Don't worry about it.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. So let's talk about where Dick Tracy places in history.
Okay.
Of the parks. For one thing, the actual premiere for this movie was held at the AMC theater at Pleasure Island. You could, they were actually opening night shows that they did across the country where it was like a Mitt one, it looked like a ticket with Dick Tracy on it. But the MGM Studios actually had their special version where it had the logo on there. But getting back into the park, on the backlot tour, where what we know is San Francisco Street now, you know, or what was San Francisco Street, that kind of little jaunt off, was actually a section that they painted to look like the movie. They didn't film Dick Tracy there, but they painted that whole area to look like Dick Tracy. They painted like the logo from the movie on one of the walls or on a fence, something like that. And they had people in like these very, you know, garish colored outfits walking around. They had, sometimes they were gangsters, like, you know, sometimes there were cops like shooting out, like there were different things happening. And part of that was a test because they really wanted to open this attraction called Dick Tracy's Crime Stoppers, which would have been very, it would have been almost a faster paced, I would think, great movie ride is how I want to put it. Like, you would have been in very large vehicles and it would have been a chase scene, like the gangsters, you know, there would be shootouts and you'd be whipping around corners and things like that. So it was the same kind of ride vehicle, but it would have been a little bit more action oriented. The movie, even though, you know, it did well, it didn't do well enough for them to think that it had that longevity, so they canned that project. What you do get is a stage show. So the Theater of the Stars, which is where Beauty and the Beast is, used to actually be in between the entrance, basically the entrance to Sunset Boulevard, where Sunset Boulevard walkway is now. That was a theater when the park first opened, or shortly thereafter. And they had a really wonderful stage show called Dick Tracy's Diamond Double Cross.
Oh, that's and a tongue twister.
That's such a 90s name.
Yes. And it was incredible. And like it didn't stick to like the wardrobe choices, like it, you know, yes, you had Tess's wardrobe was right, Dick's wardrobe was correct. But like the backdrops weren't like those classic, like the backdrops in the movie where it was very, you know, one color, you know, very primary colored. It was like, you know, the more comic strip with like the circles in the art and all of this. It just looked like a comic strip art. It didn't match up to the movie. The music obviously didn't match up. It was very 90s type music. I highly recommend YouTubing it. It's so bad, it's brilliant.
Oh, it is brilliant.
You know, someone was walking around there being like, no one wants to make no comic book films. And that person is very silly right now.
Very, very silly.
That is so, wow.
That's good.
Yeah, so basically a diamond is stolen. And Big Boy got it for Breathless Mahoney, but then he's double-crossed, and nobody knows who has the diamond, and Dick's trying to solve it, all while they're all doing song and dance. And it is just ridiculous is what it is. I don't have another word for it.
I'm going to have to watch some YouTube videos later.
I never watched that. I never saw that show.
So here's the interesting thing, and I want to see if Courtney had actually seen this, because it actually played not only at Disney or at the studios – Disneyland had it playing at Videopolis.
Yes, I just came across that right now.
So I'm going to take it you never saw that.
No. I would have been 3 when they had this show. I don't remember.
Okay. Fair enough. I'm showing my age apparently with this at this point, because I do remember watching it. The other pieces that they did have, like we were talking about earlier with the Unbreakable kind of pieces, in the costuming section, they had Breathless Mahoney's dress and Dick Tracy's trench coat and all of that on the backlot tour when you went through the costuming set.
I remember that.
So nowadays, the only thing you can really find is the in the courtyard of the Chinese theater, there's still Warren Beatty's footprints, and he has signed it with Dick Tracy, or DT, I think is actually how he signs it, DT, because he wanted to be Dick Tracy for the rest of his life.
Well, yeah, he directed, produced, and starred. I mean, if that's not getting the entire, like...
Well, yeah, but he did that on a number of films also. That was a thing.
I know, but I just, in my head, he always wears the trench coat and hat now.
Yeah. That movie made $162 million in 1990.
That's a lot of money. That's what I'm saying. Highest grossing that year. American film that year.
My God.
Ninth.
But people think that movie just did horrible.
No. Wikipedia only told me what this movie did. It had the third highest grossing opening weekend of 1990 as well. Those are my stats.
I want to look this up.
So what we're already kind of seeing with Touchstone is they were able to get big names. Yeah. Whether or not these pictures did well or we remember them well, they had, like, you know, top tier names in these, even for the time.
I just love how those parks, like, studios wasn't afraid of bringing these types of movies into the parks. Like, it wasn't like, let's just stick with animated or, you know, things like that.
And I think that has a lot to do with the audience. Look, movie audience? Okay. All right. You know what? We have an example. I'm going to tell you what the top five movies of that year was, top 10. And out of that list, there's legitimately four of them probably that would not make anywhere near that kind of money anymore because audiences have changed.
Okay.
They just want the big release, the this, the that, and that's it. All right, so Home Alone was number one that year.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
$285 million. Comedies used to do stuff like that. That's very, very rare nowadays. Number two, Ghost. Let me know the next time a movie like that makes that much money. To be number two in an entire year.
What would that be classified as?
Romantic. It's a romance. I mean, it's a
romance.
Is.
Yeah.
It's I feel a romance like they don't film. Even make those anymore. They just make rom-coms.
They kind of don't. Yeah, that's exactly. Yeah, no, you're 100% correct. Dances with Wolves was number three. All right. Oh, movies are too long. I can't pay attention for that long. So that would never happen. Pretty Woman, $178 million. Again, it might do okay. But it would never, a rom-com is very rarely, if ever, going to lock up with the top five movies of the year.
Mm-hmm.
Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, because there was a lot of cocaine in the, don't worry about that. Hunt for Red October, too brainy, can't think that much. Total Recall, well, it was a failure actually when it came out again, but it was no good. Then Die Hard 2, Dick Tracy, Kindergarten Cop, Presumed Innocent. Was the 12th highest ranked movie at the box office. Again, these are all movies that would not have that anymore. It would be a small release, you know, from like Searchlight, and you'd have to wait till Christmas for it to come out locally and stuff like that. It's just crazy how much the audience has changed.
Do you think, though, it's the audience, though?
I think it absolutely is.
Or here's my comment towards that.
Oh, okay, it's a mix, because I think I know you're going with this.
Because I would say that studios are doing the thing where I think it's like, oh, well, we see this type of film does well, so we're not going to make X type of film because we just want to bank on the type of big blockbuster. Like, you know, instead of, like, making smart kids movies, we're getting, you know, the...
Don't make me break things. Don't bring up a Studio Illumination. I don't have it in me.
We're getting those types of films. you know, and it's... What was
okay,
it?
Okay, but...
Gnomeo, you know, and Juliet?
Same with politics is with movie studios. They react to the actions of an audience.
No, yes,
and
that's
the audience
true.
Stopped going to those movies, and they were like, all right, well, you know, we're not going to make that much of those anymore. And yes... a lot of times a movie comes out and Spotlight. 20 years ago, Spotlight would have been the third highest grossing film of the entire year.
You think?
Year. Absolutely.
Well, you look at it, and some of it's transferring to where they think they can do it with, you know, they're doing long form television now, where you have like The Hunt for Red October. You know, we're getting ready to get a Jack Ryan series again that has some fairly good early buzz about it. Like, that's where these Westworld, you know, you're getting these long-form television that would have potentially been crammed into, you know, 3 hours and put into the theaters and we would have gone and see it. Now everyone is willing to sit through 12 hours of it sitting on their couch.
Yeah, on a streaming service that they could watch at their leisure.
Leisure.
Yeah, it's such a weird mix because you get like... Because like also with that list that you said, like half of them I remember. Like I remember seeing Home Alone when I was younger, but I'd never seen Hunt for Red October or Dances with Wolves.
So if I say to you, One Ping for Shirley, you've got nothing?
Well, I know you're doing a Sean Connery
One
accent.
Ping only, but you don't know who I'm talking to. I'm talking to the man who makes dinosaurs, baby. Not who makes dinosaurs, but he gets very excited at dinosaurs. He just wants to go to Montana. Jesus, we got to watch Hunt for Red October with you.
Okay.
Crimson Tide? You've seen Crimson Tide?
Nope.
So many good submarine movies.
Yeah, Down Periscope. Up
Do you
Periscope?
Know what else you should Down watch? Periscope. You know what else you should watch? You should watch The Rocketeer.
The Rocketeer?
Oh, yeah, I've never seen that
1991's
either.
1991's The Rocketeer. That was directed by none other than Joe Johnston, who also made films such as Jumanji and Captain America, The First Avenger. Yeah, that's the same
I've seen
guy.
Those.
You have. This movie kind of has a cult status now, but woof, when it came out, nobody cared.
No, wait, I think I've seen part of it because he went through a barn, right?
Everyone does. Superman even went through a barn once. I don't know what movie you watched. Could have been Terms of Endearment for all I know with that one.
No.
Does he go through a barn? He probably goes through a barn, right? Doesn't he hide his stuff in a barn at one point?
He hides it in like a...
Shanty?
Silo?
Like a... It's an aviation hangar. It's a hangar. That's the word I'm looking for.
All right. But
there is a scene that, like, in a farm field where they're testing this.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna say yeah, he probably goes through a bar.
Yeah, I remember that.
Either that or you watched Tomorrowland like less than a week ago, and that's all you're thinking of right now.
No.
Because that 100% happens in that movie.
I know that. But no, that's not what I'm thinking.
Think about, you know, the numbers we were just saying with the big board, with Dick Tracy and whatnot. The Rocketeer makes $46 million on a $35 million budget. So
What? I can't do math that quickly. What? It makes what?
$46 million, but on a $35 million budget. It only made $11 million. Dollars. Okay. Not good. Yeah, no. Science is bad egg. They were going to plan to make sequels to this, or they did. They were planning to make sequels to this, as the end of the movie blatantly tells you, as Alan Arkin is like, I can make more of these, or make it better, however Alan Arkin talks. I can't really do an Alan Arkin, guys. I'm sorry. Was that kind of close? Was it sort of close?
I don't think so. You gave him like an Italian accent or something.
Thing is, I almost went into Christopher Lloyd on Taxi.
Yeah,
it was like, you know, what does a yellow light mean? You know, slow down.
Yeah, he's that grumpy old mechanic guy. Like, that's the voice you need. That's
Schmendrick the Wizard. All right, everyone knows Schmendrick the Wizard.
There you go.
Didn't do well. It didn't find an audience. I actually kind of think it was a little bit ahead of its time. It would have been done better in this kind of area, this crowd now. I think it would have caught on a little bit more. Fun fact. Eisner wanted the helmet to be a straight-up NASA helmet. And Joe Johnston was like, get away from me. And luckily, they went with his design. And it's a very kind of iconic design. And, man, they probably make more money off selling posters about the Rocketeer now than they ever did at the box office. I didn't write down synopsis. I'm so sorry, guys. I didn't do that. I just kind of wrote down some information. Here's a quick synopsis. A boy finds rocket, boy likes girl, girl likes boy, 80s James Bond don't like boy, 80s James Bond want rocket, 80s James Bond steal rocket, boy go after rocket with bubblegum in hand, James Bond Nazi? Oh yeah. Boy defeats Nazi James Bond, mafia and cops, friends forever. The end. Alan Schmendrick the Wizard says we're going to make you a better rocket. The Rocketeer.
I was pretty sure that you were going to say girl likes rocket at one point, and I was concerned.
No, girl don't like rocket.
Jennifer Connelly is maybe the most beautiful woman of all time. I don't know.
Seconded.
That's like, really...
Seconded.
Is she drinking unicorn blood? What the hell is that woman doing? She looks the same.
It doesn't do anything for Voldemort, so it certainly isn't unicorn blood that she's drinking.
Valid.
I can touch you, Connolly.
Maybe it only works in girls, though, instead of boys.
Yeah, that's it.
Possible.
I've seen that.
I will watch this in Dark City all day long just for Jennifer Connolly.
Shell City? I always want to get to Shell City.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
All right, yeah. Shell Beach. Sorry, thank you. Sleep now, Mr. Murdoch. Oh my God, who out there is listening to this? I haven't seen Dark City. Is anyone listening to this anymore? Rocketeer, baby. That was what it was. Ryan, where is it in the parks, or where was it? Is it still there?
It is still there. So there is a little bit still there. So we're going to go through that. We'll pick up where we left off with Dick Tracy, the footprints. The Rocketeer has actual footprints in the Chinese theater area. It's footprints and literally like blast spots where the rocket went off. That's what it looks like. So go find that if you're bored in the courtyard over there while you're, you know, crying about the great movie ride or waiting for Mickey and Minnie to open with a 7-hour line.
Or both.
Or
while either doing one. Both. Yes.
But so when this came out, there was a lot of promotion for it. They really wanted to push it. The what is Pizza Rizzo now, or was Pizza Planet, if you remember that, was actually at one point called the Studio Showcase, and it was artifacts from movies that were coming out. They had the giant baby shoe from, like, Honey, I Blew Up the Baby next to a display case of the Rocketeer's rocket packs and the helmets and all kinds of stuff from this movie. So you do the math on that. You could see several pieces of it on the backlot tour. You could see especially in the later days of the tour, where you would do the tank piece and then you would go into, like, the prop warehouse. You could see different jetpacks. You could see the figurine that they test the jetpack on in the movie, all kind of stacked up on a high shelf if you were looking for it. On the backlot tour at one point, they actually had the Bulldog Cafe, which is that California Crazy building, like the building that literally looks like a bulldog sitting there that they eat in the movie. That was on the backlot tour. That set piece was sitting on the backlot tour.
I do not remember that at all.
Wow, that's – yeah, so the photo up now. I don't remember seeing that.
I gotta say, I think I have a photo of it somewhere in the Gazette's archives.
That is a weird building. I'm gonna say that right now.
Yep. Welcome to California Crazy. But you also had currently what you could still see. I wanted to figure out how I wanted to put this, but so what you could still see the Rocketeer is PB's Pipeline next to the Echo Lake area. That's where you get the frozen Cokes and the frozen kind of pieces. Peavy is Alan Arkin in the movie. It's his shop. It's his little get-up. That's why you see, like, the invented, like, machines kind of things. But if you look on the sides, you can see his schematics of the rocket pack. You can see the helmet. You can see the newspaper from the movie, you know, or a newspaper that you know that they ran the story of when he was in the air circus, like when he took off in the air circus. All of these kind of pieces, pennants and things that tie into all of that. So that's where you can still see it in the parks. But probably one of the craziest things they did to promote this movie is during the summer of 91, Sorcerer in the Sky was the fireworks show that happened over the Chinese Theater. And they actually had a guy dressed up like the Rocketeer, and they would jetpack him. He would fly in front of the Chinese Theater, kind of do a couple of circles sitting there, and then come back down and land.
That's awesome.
Right. How that didn't, you know, sell that movie is beyond me.
I am really surprised that it didn't do better than it did. But this was the time when all those movies tried and failed. Like Alec Baldwin's The Shadow. This one. Like, I don't know. Like, this time of year, like, but there was another one. The Spirit. Didn't they do a Spirit film?
The Phantom.
The Phantom. Later. Thank you. The
Phantom was in this time zone. Yeah,
yes, Billy Zane is the Phantom. I mean, how the hell does anything with Billy Zane not do well? The man was in Titanic. Come on. And he wasn't blasé about it. Because you can't be blasé about Titanic. Titanic's a good movie.
But yeah, this was a time period where I loved these movies. Like, I don't know what it – I think I must have been, like, just the right age for these movies. Because I love The Shadow, The Phantom, Dick Tracy. Like, those kind of, like, old 40s, 30s and 40s pulp type heroes. Like, that's – I fell in love with them at that time.
They look good. The thing is, they had a feel to them, and they much like the work that they're based on, they're kind of timeless in their look. I mean, if you watch them, I'm sure there's some 90s design props, you know, here and there. But in the overall, you know, that era just works really well. Sky Captain's another movie that does that with Jude Law and Angelina Jolie. And I like that movie, too. I like that genre.
Is that kind of like – it's almost a little like steampunky-esque.
It is sort of steampunky, yeah. I mean, wish a good version of The Spirit was made. Based on a Darwin Cook story directed by somebody with a brain.
Well, and that's the thing. The Rocketeer was a comic too. Like, they all had those kind of – those roots. The Shadow was more of a radio kind of production. Mm-hmm. The Dick Tracy was a comic strip. The Rocketeer – and these are both kind of older pieces. The Rocketeer was more of a modern interpretation of those stories, but it was at a comic book – before it became the movie, and then the comics went on for quite a while after.
Yeah, I like the artwork of, I think, the comics more. I think if you had done, like, an animated series of The Rocketeer, like, right with, like, the Batman animated series, I would have been down for that.
Yeah, it could work.
After school TV, that was my jam.
It definitely could have worked. You know what else worked?
What?
The movie.
No, because you know what? I think I was too young to go see it in the theaters, but if you'd put it on TV, I probably would have watched it.
Yeah, well, I have it, so you can always put it on there.
It is interesting. Like, it's become so impossible to find pieces of it. Like, you know, it's one of those soundtracks that I really love. You can hear the soundtrack still play in Epcot during the fountain show in Inventions Plaza. Part of the soundtrack from The Rocketeer is what they play in that.
That's so random.
But you can't buy the soundtrack on iTunes or any streaming service. The only way you can get it is like is the Japanese import CD still. Like, that's the only other way to get this. Like,
and it was by James Horner.
It was. Well, we talk about that. Dick Tracy's soundtrack was Danny Elfman. I mean, you know, you start looking at some of this, there were some really good chops that were being done for some of this.
And guys, James Horner was also not blasé about Titanic. Rose was trying to be. But you can't be blasé about Titanic. Movies. I love them.
Yeah.
That's my say on it.
Yeah, it's not even right. On Spotify.
That so.
Where do you want to wrap this up, my friend?
I'm going to say, I'm trying to figure out how to wrap it. So looking back, like, you know, there's not necessarily a whole lot of, there was a lot of good, there was a lot of bad of the Touchstone Pictures that they chose to do. But we were right. The studios didn't shy away from it. And some of these, I would say, honestly, at least five of the movies on this list deserve a reviewing if you haven't seen them before.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you're really bored at Christmas, give Ernest a shot.
Why not? What's the worst that could happen?
You fall asleep.
Yeah. You, like everyone else.
You're on a sleigh and you get rocketed into space.
Yeah. That was great. I had fun with that. I hope you guys had fun with that too.
I did.
Yeah, absolutely.
Apparently, I need to watch more Touchstone movies.
Well, let's not get crazy. We can go through that list and, you know, file it down. There's probably a lot good. There's probably some not so good.
There's some that we've covered here that we won't need to go back to.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. We'll look at that list.
Okay.
All right, but they are a Touchstone. Hey-o. Guys, no matter what you ever hear, don't forget that I once knew a person who seriously asked me, in reference to the scene in Little Mermaid where she gets up on the rock and the water comes over. And the question was, how many times do you think they had to film it to get it right?
What?
And Pete, with squinted eyes, stared at that person for 30 seconds straight.
Did you just slap them directly in the forehead and walk away?
I just stared at them. I threw the squint your eyes like, what? I couldn't even get out the noise.
You should have gone like Rafiki style on them and just like backhand.
Yeah, it was a girl. I can't do that. I would be arrested. But yes.
Was this also the same girl that asked if you had jet lag when you were flying from New York to Florida?
Nope, but that was another woman that I did know. I did not date her, though. That was not my girlfriend or anything like that. But yes, asked me if I was tired from the jet lag from the flight from Florida to New York.
Wait, the first one was a girlfriend?
No, that was a friend of a girlfriend.
I was gonna
basically
say.
Don't meet people. Just overall. Just stay
it wasn't in. Me either time, so
wasn't
that's all
that. Got plenty of stories for that. When the time comes. Everybody, first off, thank you, Ryan, for putting all that together.
Yeah, that was fun, Ryan.
No problem.
I hope all of you had a really good time. And I think that's it for this week.
Okay.
Is that it? All right, guys, this week's episode has been brought to you by MEI Travel. For all your vacation planning needs, visit the people over at MEI-travel.com, where Becky and her team can get you started on your own adventure, and you can fight 80s James Bond Nazis and save the world. Who are we, though? We're not 80s James Bond Nazis, not that I know of, anyway. We are Last Gen Podcast. That's LASTGEN. podcast.com. You can find us on the Twitter at Diz Magic Hour Pod. Do we do anything on that Twitter?
Yeah.
All right.
I do.
We're on Facebook. If you search Disney Magic Hour, we have a group. How about that? Who would have thought it? People who are on Facebook, probably. If you're already in there, add your friends. And if you're not there, join. If you're not on Facebook, don't worry. Just listen to the show. Facebook is, you don't have to worry about it. iTunes. We're on iTunes. We're on Google Play Music, Stitcher. Melissa, very active on the Instagram, though.
Yes, I do try and put a picture up a day.
Yes, picture a day. So where can everyone find that?
At Disney Magic Hour Podcast on Instagram.
And if you like what you hear here, wait, what? Yes,
hear.
Right? You can help support the show over at patreon.com But where's the second half of that address, Melissa?
/Disney Magic Hour.
Yay! So everyone can go there and support it. You can become a production assistant level and join us for our live weekly threads, which it's been tough trying to schedule that with everybody's schedule. So we are thinking of alternative ways of sort of filling that gap and that responsibility to make that seem worth it for everyone.
Yeah, I've got some ideas brewing.
Melissa's got ideas a brewing. Basically reshooting that scene from Little Mermaid right on top of those. Ryan Wilson, where can everyone find man at the Main Street Gazette?
They can find it at mainstgazette.com. If you're looking for us on Instagram or Twitter, it's mainstgazette. And if you search for Main Street Gazette on Facebook, you'll find the page we have.
And Courtney, where can everyone find what's our initials? DMH Book Club? I legitimately didn't remember. I almost said DC.
You can find the DMH Book Club on Facebook if you search for DMH Book Club. I almost said DMH Face Club. Pete just passed on the stroke that he had. I had a little bit of one too. Anyway, this week we're finishing up The Princess Companion and we'll be recording our podcast on that. And we're going to start The Princess Fugitive next week. So
start,
tune
maybe
in.
Maybe I've already finished.
Yeah, maybe Melissa read it. I waited. I was trying to read with you guys. So
I'm
waiting.
It.
Melissa will reread, I'm sure.
Can I just ask a question? Is Tommy Lee Jones in that?
No.
No, Harrison Ford is, though.
I didn't kill my wife.
Yeah.
Shakes his finger at you. Wasn't Fleischer in that, too? Anyways. Guys, ladies, gentlemen, people, animated characters, have a good weekend. Have a good week. We'll see you all next week. And say goodnight, Melissa.
Goodnight, Melissa.
Say goodnight, Ryan.
Goodnight, Ryan.
Say goodnight, Courtney.
Goodnight, Courtney.
Goodnight, Pete. Bye.
Bye.